Do you think for the draft and basically, you know, him and I,
We're going to start with Patrick Cronin is the first discussant who's going to make some comments.
Thank you very much. Three excellent papers and three good presentations, which were complementary to what's in the papers, in my opinion. I really don't have a lot of arguments with the papers. I really want to try to make some points that embellish on the points that were made under this panel's topic of military issues in the Korean Peninsula. Military issues, of course, is an artificial circumscription. That is, you cannot really divorce military issues from the political objectives you're trying to seek and the political and strategic context in which you're facing the issue. So the first set of questions for me revolves around what is the North Korean problem, or what is the set of problems we're trying to address with respect to North Korea today and in the future. The one we've been focused on so heavily is the nuclear issue, and I think this has been an overly myopic fixation. We've done the typically American thing from a Washington perspective, I'm just talking about the US policy here, of over-reducing the problem into just the nuclear issue. Not because, I don't take exception to the fact that the nuclear issue is very dangerous and must be addressed, but rather it's just not sufficient. It's a necessary but not sufficient part of what needs to be a more comprehensive approach to thinking about the North Korean problem. In a very simplistic sense, if you're building a nuclear weapon as the ultimate insurance policy, it's not going to be the first thing you're going to sell or give away or trade away or bargain away in order to get to other objectives. It's just not going to happen. So we have to think about it in different ways, both in terms of deterrence and defense, but also in terms of other objectives we should be pursuing. I think as Bruce Bechtel pointed out, the focus and the need to focus on provocation is a whole second set of challenges that we've learned in the last 2 years, in particular, the need to focus on these issues quite properly so, although there are huge questions as to whether we have this counter-provocation joint strategy right. I think this is more dynamic. It's not a fixed target either, not only because North Korea changes their tactics, techniques, and procedures every time they do something, trying to prevent us, for instance, from understanding the attribution even, that this was definitely, clearly, that day, a North Korean attack, but also because we have to recognize that there are going to be other provocations, and we can't simply stop with what we do militarily. We have to then think about the political opportunity that that crisis has provided the alliance. In other words, the engagement with certain military figures in North Korea, perhaps. The strengthening of the ROK-US alliance for political messaging to China in the region. We want to send signals. So we ought to be thinking clearly about the political objectives as well as the operational and tactical military issues of our counter-provocation strategy. In thinking about the set of problems for dealing with North Korea and its asymmetrical challenges, and here let me just think about the cyber equation, or other, or special operations forces. I just returned from Burma, from Rangoon, Yangon, saw the Martyrs Mausoleum, and it's a reminder of just how indirect but lethal North Korean forces can be when you think about what might happen in the future. So we have to think about the whole spectrum, as indeed Bruce Klingner writes in his paper, of operations that we're addressing here. And it seems to me we're dealing with the need to try to minimize North Korean miscalculation, make it unmistakable. We're trying to do that with unavoidable toughness in terms of our alliance position in military buildup. But we're thirdly trying to do this in a way that addresses our own uncertainty about their decision-making process. It was Hyun In-taek, the former unification minister, who just recently in town talked about how North Korea's military is now engaged in almost every aspect of decision-making in North Korea. At least it's increasingly involved in the decision-making in North Korea, so far as he knows, and maybe many in this room know. So we have to recognize that we're dealing with a very uncertain structure here. A second set of issues deals with then the relationship of these North Korean challenges or problems we're trying to address with the strategies that we wish to adopt, the ones that we want our military forces to be part of, the political ends. On December 20th of this year, I submit, our two governments ought to be sitting down privately with officials who will be going into government, if they're not already there, to map out a strategy for the next 5 years that will be able to be implemented beginning in February of 2013. There's a huge opportunity and requirement to do that. The strategy for dealing with the nuclear issue, I believe, we need a strategy that boxes in the nuclear power but also achieves other objectives. And I think, from my perspective, it's a matter of a much stronger information strategy. Information ops have been largely marginalized in everything we're doing, but it's information that will ultimately transform the decision-making of North Korea. China and South Korea are too rich. Information is too permeable. The contradictions of North Korea are too great for this not to be a powerful tool over time. Over time, because the mindset is so entrenched over so many decades of having only been a guerrilla state or a medieval dynasty, it can't change quickly. But I've done a study on just the 50,000 North Korean workers in Kaesong Industrial Complex, and whatever you think about that, because there's too much rent going to Pyongyang, there's no question in the minds of anybody who's worked in Kaesong that it's opened up the eyes of the North Korean workers and by extension their families. If we could come up with more instruments for changing minds and getting information in North Korea without paying a heavy rent to the central government, then this could be a highly beneficial part of a strategy. And the military plays a role in that, because the military will create the opportunities and must create the opportunities for this. It's engaging the mid-level military in North Korea that will open up channels to the inner circle and ultimately allow more information to flow in at the grassroots, in my perspective. Anyway, I think there are other strategies here, though, that we have to think about, including the ROK's role as a middle power, well beyond the Korean Peninsula. And here, there are many things that can be done beyond what South Korea has already done. Let me cite the Burma case. As right now in Burma's very fragile transition, the military is not being engaged. So you have a military elite who are essentially retired to the mountainside outside of Naypyidaw with their Singapore bank accounts filled with millions of dollars based on jade, gold, timber, hydrocarbons. And then you've got the real military officers, basically the mid-level officers, who have not been corrupted by that old system. They need to be engaged. And South Korea may be the best model. And the South Korean military may be one of the best organizations to engage. So even in this kind of way, there may be a very important role to play there. Let me talk about means, the third sort of category of questions I had. A lot was said about missile defense, and C4ISR, the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, both in terms of alliance capability, of South Korean capability, also the potential for regional networking. Here, the information agreement that ROK signed with Japan, however controversial, is a harbinger of what will be a much bigger network of information that can come in the future and should come, not just because we have to deal with the North Korean threat, but also because however we deal with North Korea in the coming years, that's ultimately our disposition for dealing with the future with China as well, because it will be much, much harder to augment any forces in the region after the North Korean issue is attenuated. we heard about PAC-3. PAC-3 is essential. PAC-2 is not the same. And South Korea needs it desperately. It's not just the SM-3, which is absolutely needed now, but it's the Standard Missile 6, the extended range, I would argue, plus THAAD, plus new radars. What we need to be doing, though, is we can be taking these capabilities between RK and US and doing data link exercises and other relatively low-cost exercises to signal. So one of our provocation approaches ought to be, every time North Korea does something we don't like, if it's not lethal force, where we now have clear rules of engagement on what to do, and then we should be seeking a political objective on top of that military engagement, if it's non-lethal, but it's something we don't like another missile test, a nuclear test, then we ought to be definitely saying, you've just paid a price, we have increased ROK capability, and by the way, China, if you haven't noticed, US and ROK are stronger in this region, we've just augmented it through some specific things, both exercising and in procurement, every time, that's the price they will pay, and that's good. And that way, then we still open up a political channel for dialogue, because we want that information. We need the information from North Korea just to try to avoid miscalculation. We want it for our contingency planning. We want it ultimately to open up a schism, potentially in different camps, and finally to allow information in. We can be strengthening the UN command as well, bringing in third countries, other countries. There are already 8 European countries meeting with the British this morning, represented. Those can be very, very helpful in terms of the international support, also sending a political signal to China in the region. And finally, the US and the ROK need to be both building up in doing proper procurement, and maybe this is sort of in Bruce Klingner's paper more than any of the others. There are huge questions about what is proper procurement. So when Bruce talks about the need for the ROK to buy all of the things he lists, that's tough for any budget. I'm thinking about the Australians right now, who had a great white paper in 2009. They've just adopted a new approach as they write a new white paper that's slashing their budget, and they can't simply buy. ROK economy is not growing at the pace that they had hoped and we'd hoped, and U.S. is facing hugely austere budget possibilities, as was mentioned, with sequestration. So it's very important to make some tough trade-offs, and so there are choices I could get into, like what you do with the fighter issue, which is the issue number one for the Korean Air Force and the Korean government right now. And I've watched other allies make a decision that we've over-optimized a lot of systems, we spend the bank on them, and then we can't do the kind of agility we maybe need for all these things. And for the United States on the so-called pivot, the refocusing, this is a long-term posture question, and unless we can be sustainable in terms of our own economic strength, and unless we can sustain a strong enough force posture, not just maritime, which is part of the maritime region, but our ground forces and our ground engagement as well, and air, obviously, we won't be taken seriously. And here's where the fact that General Thurman's had to ask for just to get back forces back to where they used to be, he shouldn't have to do that. I mean, it should have been Washington pushing almost forces out there, as we've seen these provocations in the last couple of years, to make sure that there is an unmistakable commitment on the part of the United States to help the ROK in the event of another provocation. I'll stop with those comments, and thank you very much.
To save the time, I will tell 3 or 4 my viewpoint on each paper. The first paper, Dr. Hong, the first point. Dr. Hong argued the following: the North Korean military first policy elevate its military to the primary position in a government or society in North Korea. This argument quite correct. This is very, I agree completely this argument. I would like to add this argument in order to understand Dr. Hong's argument, we should know what the real North Korea military post is. The North Korea under the Kim Jong-un regime or Kim Jong-un regime had kept a strong conviction that North Korea's the strong military power is, I discussed the dictionary, the magic mallet of goblin. This is in Korean word, bokkabi bujakbakmi, to solve the every difficult issue for North Korea. The North Korea military first policy has one of the most valuable political philosophy in Korean society, from the Kim Jong-il regime to the President Kim Jong-un regime. For example, on last April 15, after the North Korea missile test, the Kim Jong-un vowed to the enhance the military first policies. He mentioned the following: so, to build a socialist strong and prosperous nations, we should strengthen the people's army as first, second, and third priorities. This means Kim Jong-un also very strongly keep his father's the military first policies. So, to understand more the North Korea military first policy, we should know the another one important thing to the military first policy. That is, there are three important strategic goals of North Korea military first policy. The first one, this is their convictions. North Korea military power is the fundamental power to communize the entire Korean peninsula unification under communist control. This means if they have a strong their military power, they'll be able to, in the future, they'll achieve the entire Korean peninsula under the communist control. The second argument, North Korean military power is the security power to protect the North Korean regimes. This means if they keep strong military power, the North Korean regime will be never collapse. The third one, the North Korean military power is the a kind of a strong bargaining power for the North Korean national interests. So this means if they keep the strong military power, they will win any kind of the bargaining internationally toward the South Korea. If we understand those three kind of strategic goal of North Korean military power, we completely agree Dr. Hong's the argument. The North Korean military first policy elevates North Korean military to the primary position in the government. My second point, Hong's argument, they argue like this one. In sum, North Korea policy is superior to South Korea in quantity, but the imperial in quality is generally correct. However, the argument that the North Korean military is inferior to South Korea in quality, in some part, is not correct. I should consider the following factors. We should consider the following factors in order to measure the quality of military power. For example, the modernization of military weapons, specialty of military manpower, military operational system, military discipline, military soldiers, moral attitude, etc. If we compare to Korea's in terms of the above factors, the military discipline and the military soldiers' moral attitude of North Korea would not be inferior to those of the South Korean military soldiers. I'll show one example. I once had a chance to see a North Korean film who showed some scenes of the military training course for North Korea Special Task Forces, 특수부대. The first scene in the film, the first scene was that the North Korean soldiers were working on a broken class with the real fit. 맨발로 유리깨진데 막걸댕긴 훈련. So we cannot imagine such kind of scene with the South Korean soldiers. And the second scene showed that the North Korean soldiers were driving nails in a wooden board with their foreheads. So 이마로 큰 대못을 널판지에 박아대는 장면. So don't try to do that. If you try to do that instead of driving nail in the wooden board, maybe our forehead will be broken. The third scene was that the North Korean soldiers were naked and were beaten with heavy wooden sticks. The wooden stick were broken. So if we tried to me, maybe every bone for me will be broken. So this means we can see North Korean soldiers have been trained under such extreme, brutal, harsh training courses. South Korean soldiers, on the other hand, we don't have such kind of a training course. So if we see this kind of example, we cannot argue the South Korean military power in terms of quality is stronger than the North Korean. My third point is, Hong argued, there is no question that the North Korean regime is a group that cannot be understood logically, is quite correct. This argument, I think, the former U.S. Defense Minister William J. Perry's argument is very equal, very same. Maybe it's 1994, around William Perry visited several times the North Korea. After his visiting, he concluded that North Korea is an enigmatic country. So here, enigmatic means unpredictable, mysterious, illogical. In this sense, Dr. Hong's arguments exactly the same. Defense Minister William Perry's argument. Lastly, Dr. Hong argues in his conclusion, the ROK-US combined forces have a reasonable sufficiency for countering North Korea's military provocation and the asymmetric strategy. Then, however, the ROK-US combined forces never conducted deterrence and retaliation power against North Korea when North Korea conducted military provocations on two occasions in 2010. So we may not say that the ROK-US combined forces have a reasonable sufficiency. The above things about Dr. Hong's papers. And I will move second paper. Second paper is Dr. Bechtol's the paper. In a word, Dr. Bechtol's paper, a very excellent one, to be able to contribute it, increase the South Korean military power. When I heard the Bechtol's the presentation, I couldn't but feel that we Koreans should take him to Korea to get the ideas to complement the South Korea with military power from him. Anyway, Dr. Bechtol analyzed very well the domestic and the international situation both before and after North Korea's last missile test, last April 13th. For example, he analyzed very well in his paper the domestic situation in North Korea at that time, and he also analyzed well North Korea's South Korea policy. Also, he did so well 2009 agreement between the United States, North Korea, and he analyzed well the responses of South Korea, United States, Japan, the UN, and the Philippines. after the declaration of the North Korean Daepodong to test us. He analyzed all those issues very systematically and exactly. My second point about Dr. Bechtol's paper, Dr. Bechtol argued like this one. The aspect of the test launch conducted during last April is related to proliferation. The 12 member Iranian delegation was sent to North Korea to observe the launch. The future successful launch of the Daepodong missile system will mean hundreds of millions of dollars in sales from North Korea to Iran. Is quite correct. I completely agree with Dr. Bechtol's argument. The proliferation of the missile technology from North Korea to Iran, I think this is one of the worst aftermaths of North Korean missile test of North Korea last missile test. We should keep in mind this one. The third point, Dr. Bechtol's argument, South Korea policymakers would be wiser to consider the Japanese model in terms of Korean MD. I completely support this argument in terms of the defending South Korea from North Korea's missile attacks. Though there have been several kinds of views in terms of the Korean MD, Koreans who understand the real situation of the North Korean missile threat should support Dr. Bechtol's this argument. The last my point about Dr. Bechtol's paper, Dr. Bechtol's conclusion is that even though the North Korean regime changed from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, its military provocation have been continuing. His argument is quite correct. Here I'd like to add the reason why North Korean regime has been conducting such kind of continuing the provocations. I would like to mention some point to the, on the background of the North Korean military continuing the provocation. The first background would be to increase the symbolic capability of Kim Jong-un regimes. This is one of North Korea's domestic factors. The North Korea regime has been using its capabilities in symbolic terms. In other words, the Kim Jong-un regime has been trying to present tough and strong image to its people and other countries, especially against the South Korea with its military provocations. This is a way to increase its weak political legitimacy. The second background is to revamp the Imeongbak and Obama administration North Korea policies. North Korea has been berating President Lee's North Korea policy and U.S. President Obama's North Korea policies. North Korea has been missing the sunshine policy, so-called left-leaning South Korean government. They want again such kind of sunshine policy. So North Korea has worked to provoke social unrest in South by inducing friction between conservative and pro-North Korea leftist element. So they are trying to conduct such kind of military provocations. Okay, I'll stop here. Remain.
No, it's good because Mr. Klinger had to leave anyway, so he can't hear your comment on his paper. And it's time for the last discussion. Thank you.
Last one, I think I deserve the last requirement. first. Civilian first policy place rather than military first policy place.
Yeah, the ambassador said so before.
It's not in North Korea. Actually, I'm in the active service, Korean Navy Captain General, waiting for wonderful retirement from the Navy at the end of this year. You know, when I look at the three papers, I'm not going to just repeat what they said. I got just some idea that some praise, it is praise. The devil dances in the details, which may be found in the wall of some building in the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Devil dances in the details. I can interpret in two ways, in conjunction with the way they write their papers. I'm not criticizing the paper that I need to add some comment on the paper so that the paper can be the fruitful and the rich fruit. Anyway, the first way to interpret the praise is that if you fail in the details, then you're going to end up with a disaster, in the end. That's the first interpret I can make. Second way I can interpret with the praise is that, going into detail for something is really difficult. That's why people just like to avoid going detail. In conjunction with writing paper, they just like to, they don't like to go into detail like in-depth analysis, and the one-by-one analysis is very makes you feel sometimes heavy. So, when we look at paper or the other things, then we can identify it is more of the abstract level, or it's more of a concrete level. But the three paper generally more of the hardware rather than software, more of the high level concept rather than operation level which you want to apply. So anyway, in this venue, I want to make some comment on their paper. Actually, I have spent a few years teaching in naval war college, military strategy and maritime strategy. But the level I taught is just operational level. So, what I like to hear or listen from the paper is just the operational level of knowledge we can directly apply to our case, but that's not, that's why I want some add a comment to their papers. First, like the paper presented by the Dr. Hong, his topic is North Korea capabilities to conduct military provocation and the Iraq and the U.S. Capability to counter them. So just as implied by those topics, then we can certainly expect some underlying something, which we like to hear, but there's no actually underlying the concept or any underlying the strategic concept. So let me bring, as a way of the adding some comment, the proactive deterrence. It's now in place. 2010 of May, President Lee announced the proactive deterrence as the official strategy we need to adopt. But since then, actually, there are some lots of questions and inquiries regarding the concept has been raised. But clearly manifested the concept of the proactive deterrence. The only thing we have been understanding about the proactive deterrence is that it may mean simply to exercise of the right of self-defense or the prevent management of the North Korean provocation. That's all we understand as some component of the concept of proactive deterrence. But the right of self-defense and also the prevent management of the provocation is not a component that can make the the definition of the proactive deterrence. It's actually a guiding principle by which our the behavior, action should be guided by. So actually it's not the component we can use in making the definition of the word the proactive deterrence. So let me bring some key word to make the definition of the proactive deterrence. One is the responsibility. Actually, from etymological origin, we can find the proactive deterrence is composed of two concepts. One is responsibility. The other is initiative. It's actually, the word we can find in just the management literature, but we can apply those concepts to our situation. Responsibility, we can broke down and we can have two detailed thing. One is the ability, and the other is the response. So we can combine them together, then it means ability to choose our response. That's the original meaning of responsibility, which is the one component of the proactive deterrence. The other one is the initiative. But regarding initiative, I mean, we all are very familiar with the meaning. So first one, I mean, responsibility, there's a very famous word, the box stops here. I mean, whether the deterrence will fail or succeed is our responsibility. So it shouldn't be left with as much of the other country like North Korea, whether the deterrence will fail or not. So that's why we need to have some ability we can use as a way of responding to the provocation from North Korea. That's the responsibility. And the initiative, in order to understand initiative, we need to bring two more concepts. One is the paradox. The other one is some escalation control. You know, if you look at the North Korean behavior when they provoke, they try to the taking use of the what we call the stability and instability paradox. You know, the botching up at trivial matters with no bond whatsoever, but staking all things on what important ones. I mean, at higher level meaning just the general world, it's just less likely. But in the situation, the low level, like low intensity conflict, is more likely to happen. So I mean, from North Korea, the position is very easy to take the advantage of those paradox. So even North and South, they do not they want to go into the all-out war. But still, North Korea, they like to instigate the military provocation at low level. I mean, it's very easy to happen that way. But from the low level to the up until last stage, just below the all-out war, then the last of the escalation, the procedure. But the initiative is just held by North Korea and taken by North Korea as its advantage. So as long as North Korea try to use the initiative using the escalation control, then always we're going to lose, and North Korea will win. So that's why sometimes nothing can do, even when North Korea instigate the provocation. That's why we need some way, in a manner of proactive rather than reactive. That's why we need a proactive. So North Korea in this case, every time North Korea instigates, then it's very limited in terms of how we react to the provocation. So what's the best way to overcome this this chronic problem, which is the paradox and North Korea escalation control strategy, there are lots of ways, but one of the way is to use tailored response strategy. Let me bring two types of strategy. One is it's a deterrent strategy actually. One is a general deterrent strategy, the other is a immediate strategy, immediate deterrent strategy. So in mode of general deterrent strategy, we'll use the standing threat in order to prevent North Korea from you know, the conducting or from considering some action, but in mode of immediate deterrence, we use the immediate threat in order to prevent North Korea from doing something that is really significantly considered. So I mean, it's quite different. If we look at when North Korea waged the provocation, then we have to identify, is that designed for just the all-out war, but just designed for some political action? I mean, we're looking at some North Korea provocation, is it some harbinger for general war sign? Then, I mean, we have to prepare the other way, like general deterrence. In general deterrence mode, I mean, the asset we can use is, I mean, is great. I mean, because using that, we just get rid of North Korea yield to fire or they're willing to fire. I mean, the object in deep in the area, North Korea territory. But the North Korea provocation is designed to, you know, just for some political reason, then we have to use immediate deterrence measure. In this mode, we can use the asset just available right now to the target just nearby. Like you may know, North Korea to show batteries and surface missiles and even, you know, the submarines in the area, they can go in, they can go undetected. So if we have something we can use against those target nearby, then I mean, it may have a deterrence effect. But still, we don't have to worry about the escalating into the all-out war. So that's the immediate deterrence, the deterrence mode. So in this way, we need to be tailored as circumstances allowed. Last one, you know, today nobody talk about defense, but I'm talking about deterrence, but defense should be used as a complementary to the deterrence, because in the Cold War mode, you know, the deterrence is not comparable with defense, because I mean, if we have the spear and the shield, then I mean, it more like to fight together. But you know, if we get rid of the shield, then just left is the spear, then it's really hard to fight again together. So we need this in analogy in mind. In the Cold War, defense is a source of instability. But in this case, defense is a source of stability in our case. Because I mean, we don't believe in North Korea. Even you know, we agree that, well, we get rid of our shield, but North Korea can see it, then suddenly it can be with the shield, with the spear, then I will lose. So we don't believe North Korea. That's why, you know, in this case, defense should be provided as a complementary means to our deterrence. So deterrence should be comparable with deterrence. I mean, there are lots of ways, anyway. But we provide this way, then we will implement the what we call the proactive deterrence. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to comment. You know, the North Vietnamese film showing the military banging the nail in the board with their head. It's a bad idea, but you know, the Iraq Marines have a similar drinking game to that. They just don't have a nail on the table. You just bang your head there. You should talk to them. Okay, so now we have 15 minutes for questions. Sir.
Larry Nix from CSIS. This is to Bruce. First of all, Bruce, compliments for bringing up the North Korean-Iranian relationship, which is a big financial benefit to North Korea. You said more about it in your presentation. The State Department has been willing to say about it for the last 5 years, frankly. Now, my question has to do with missile defense. I have read and heard two South Korean arguments as to why South Korea should not make a big investment in missile defense. The first of these arguments, as I understand it, is that Seoul is so close to the DMZ that there would not be sufficient reaction time to fire interceptors, intercepting missiles, before North Korean missiles would be raining down on Seoul. And the second argument, again, as I understand it, is that North Korea has over 1,000 Scuds and Nodong missiles. And if it fired most or all of these at targets in South Korea, it simply would overwhelm whatever SA-2s or SA-3s South Korea would have. And a lot of those missiles would get through and strike the targets. Would you address, this is what I understand some South Koreans argue, would you address those points?
Well, great question as always, Larry. First, let me talk about the PAC-3s. The answer is to the individual who said that, it's a, how do I put this nicely, a stupid argument. It's not true. If it was true, then why do we have PAC-3s on Yongsan, American PAC-3s, protecting an American base? And as you know, Yongsan is in Seoul. What the South Koreans need is that two-tiered approach, as you know. Like, again, as I said, like the Japanese system, you know, the higher tier for the Nodongs and the lower tier for PAC-3s. It's not true. But one thing I know for sure that is true, if they have nothing, it's really bad. And they need those PAC-3s. The PAC-2 is not effective. And for those of you who are not missile guys, this is not complicated. I'm not a technocrat myself either. But the PAC-2 is like firing a shotgun at a missile when it's coming in. You know, a shotgun blast, a PAC-3 is like firing a bullet at a bullet. It's that much more accurate. So I think buying these PAC-3s for Seoul and other cities and military bases, population centers as well, is very important. I would not agree with the assessment you have. I've heard that before. I heard that at an ICKS symposium we had at Heritage about 4 years ago, and myself and General Harris both said that's just simply not true. So getting to your second question, a volley. Let me get to the numbers. The numbers are not exact because the North Koreans don't turn those figures over to us. Here's our rebuttal. But the best guess that I have is that they have about 600 Scuds, B, C, D, and extended range Scuds, about 200 Nodongs, and about 200 Musudong missiles to total 1,000. So it's not a total of 1,000 of Scuds. They're not going to fire Musudongs at Korea and South Korea. A lot of those Nodongs in a war would be aimed at Japan as well. But, you know, 600 Scuds is a lot of Scuds, and they probably have enough TELs to launch volleys of them, although it wouldn't be 600 at a time, it'd probably be several dozen at a time. The PAC-3s may not be able to take out all of them, any more than any other defense system would be able to take out all of anything, but they would certainly save a lot of lives. And I think that's very important. So I hope that answered your questions.
Yeah. Back here. Yeah,
Rich. Richard Shin. This question is for Bruce. We'd like to pick on you, Bruce. I think your arguments to South Korean government officials, and their position has not been the one that Larry's given, but it's more of, you know, look, what is the likelihood that North Korea will actually attack Seoul in a sense that we really need these things, and the costs are so prohibitive that it's probably not worth it. And that's, you know, I get this comment quite often. So the question that I have is, and looking at all the three papers, you know, we have these strategies and, you know, what we need, but there's nothing about cost and priorities. And I was wondering if you could address that point. Is it the PAC-3s that are most important around Seoul, or is it going to be, you know, SM-3s? And if they are, you know, where, and could you address that particular point? Thanks.
Well, you know, if those people who said that they wouldn't attack South Korea with Scuds, who else would they attack with those Scuds? They don't have the range to reach Japan. They're not going to attack China with them. Those Scuds are there for one purpose, to attack South Korea. And right now, South Korea has nothing to deter a Scud attack, and deterrence is important, except for a full-scale war. So it's, you know, it, to me, it's very imprudent to say, we know what these missiles are for, we know who they're aimed at, but we're not gonna apply deterrence because we don't think they'll ever use them. I don't agree with that. The other thing is, talking about PAC-3s, of course, they would be most important for Seoul. If the North Koreans were going to use NODONs against South Korea, obviously that would be a much different trajectory, fired like this instead of like that. If they were, not exactly, I mean, I don't have a protractor with me right now, but if they were to fire those at South Korea, they would probably aim those at places like Daegu and Taejon and Gwangju and Jeju-do. But of course they wouldn't have to use as many of those, because they now have the extended range Scud, which has a range of 850 kilometers, and they've tested that successfully. They tested that in 2009. So one would think that for the most part, the PAC-3s would probably be the most important. The SM-3 will be important for the very, very long range stuff, and it probably won't be as overwhelmed as a PAC-3 systems would be. Does that answer your question?
And the cost?
A lot. And let me tell you, I'm not going to kid you. The issue with that is, and Bruce brought this up. There are rumors, but they're probably accurate, that South Korea has said now they're going to join the U.S.-led BMD system. So that's probably in the works. Probably going to happen sometime this year. At least that's what I'm hearing. That's a good thing. The problem with that is that South Korea will join the U.S.-led. Anyway, that's a good thing. The bad thing is South Korea doesn't have that ballistic missile defense systems to really contribute to that system like Japan does or like the United Kingdom does. So they need to purchase those PAC-3s and SM-3s. But most importantly, the U.S. simply does not have the resources to give those to South Korea. You can't squeeze blood out of a stone. So that's something for the South Koreans to consider. And if you're going to spend all the money on those long-range ballistic missiles to fire at North Korea, my thought on that would be maybe you should look at spending that money on ballistic missile defense instead. That might be budget money better spent.
Back there.
Right. I'll project. Ian Reinhardt, CRS. I was really intrigued by Michael Maza's recent piece about tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea. When I first heard the idea broached, I thought it sounded ridiculous and counterproductive. But his argument is that, if I'm understanding it correctly, it's not the military value, it's the political value. So my question is for the whole panel, with the reintroduction of tactical nuclear weapons, could that serve any productive purpose, or is that simply counterproductive?
Missile capability is very important. It has a great meaning politically rather than militarily. For example, missile defense system.
He's asking about nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons. I presented the conventional military capability rather than nuclear capability. So,
I think I would take,
Nuclear capability. If the U.S. Deployed tactical nuclear weapons to South Korea, it has a great meaning in political for deterring North Korean provocations. But at the same time, it is contradictory to South Korea's defense policy. So I think we'd better keep the basic principle of defense policy, not to deploy the tactical nuclear weapons on South Korea.
Anyone else want to take a stab at that one?
Yeah, so it's relating to the extended deterrence question. Then, there are the conditions. Extended deterrence would be so political ones. If we have a very friendly, close relationship with the United States, South Korea, this would be okay. But it's changing like the weather. So if the new United States government changed and the South Korea government changed, we cannot believe the extended deterrence. So the precondition, we should believe each other. If there is not belief, we don't need such kind of extended deterrence. This is the political difference.
Okay, we had a question here. Yes, this gentleman right here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Very short questions. First question, financial questions. How many percent from budget go in South Korea for military needs and North Korea? And second, I'm not clear why North Korea made all kind of provocations to South Korea. I mean, like madness. While the United States have all military forces in South Korea, who can touch Korea? No Russia, no the most potential army in the world. So not clear why they do this, to show that they are mad, or they have other reasons. What reasons in the result?
Okay.
Please allow me to answer your question, if I may.
Yeah, we're good.
I actually answered that in my comments, and it's in the paper. North Korea conducts provocations to create instability and terror within South Korea. North Korea is a rogue nation state. By the way, the title of my first book, Red Rogue, available on Potomac Books, 2095. That is why they do it. And they do it very smart, asymmetrically. I learned from one of my mentors who's standing up there about asymmetric warfare, hit them where they're not. And South Korea, frankly, is very susceptible because of the way the islands are situated near the northern limit line. And that's why we've seen a lot of provocations in that area. The other thing about budget is, you know, that this General Son is probably the most qualified guy to comment on that in South Korea, but the national legislature has been dominated by conservatives since 2008. And yet the military budget, the defense budget in South Korea is still less than 3%. And that's been something that's been very controversial. And General Son could probably comment on that. But let me comment on North Korea's military budget. It is at least 30% of their GDP every year, at least, and probably more. Granted, they have a much smaller GDP than South Korea.
Well, we're out of time for this panel. Let's thank them for all their efforts.
Okay, great. I love your panelists. The opposition is a matter of getting the